Welcome to Mastering Logical Fallacies, the online course. This is the audio version of the online course presented at MasteringLogicalFallacies.com. For the complete learning experience, including multimedia presentations, quizzes, assignments, peer-to-peer discussion, instructor interaction, and more, enroll as a student at MasteringLogicalFallacies.com. My name is Beau Bennett, and I am your instructor for this course. Moving the goalposts is demanding from an opponent that he or she address more and more points after the initial point has been satisfied adequately. This is basically just a refusal to give any kind of compromise or to concede in any way to the point. And as you can imagine, this is done out of pride, out of foolishness, not out of the pursuit of truth, not out of respect for reason or logic, but it has a lot to do with our emotional state at the time. So is it always fallacious to demand more and more reasons for something and more evidence? Is that always moving the goalposts? Well, no. Sometimes it makes perfect sense to do so. And let's talk about this distinction. Let's say, for example, that you do not believe in the Easter Bunny. And you don't believe in the Easter Bunny because there's about 1,000 reasons not to believe in the Easter Bunny. But somebody asks you, well, how come you don't believe in the Easter Bunny? And just really as a dismissive way of not going into a huge 4-hour debate as to why you do not believe in the Easter Bunny, you simply say, all right, how could a bunny rabbit deliver candy all over the world simultaneously or within one night? And then let's just say, hypothetically, that this person is able to give you a very reasonable sounding, plausible excuse on how, let's say there's not just one main Easter bunny, but there's millions of bunnies that actually do it through some kind of delivery system that has to do with quantum entanglement and a certain kind of intelligence-based genetic modification of the rabbits that allows them to do such a thing. And you could go on. You get the point. And then after you say, okay, great. So let's just pretend that that's possible. Well, how about this then? And then you go on and you just name some more reasons. The person can't say, you're wrong. You're moving the goalposts here. You told me that you don't believe in the Easter Bunny because of this whole time distance problem. And no, that's not what actually happened. You gave the person just one of the many countless reasons why you don't believe in such a silly thing. And you are just addressing these points. As your opponent is responding to these, you are addressing new points and new arguments that come up just as to why you don't believe. So in that case, that's not necessarily moving the goalposts. That's just simply presenting a series of arguments that all support your disbelief. But now let's talk about when it actually is a fallacy or can be seen as a fallacy. Let's say that you believed in God all your life, and then one day, fairly recently, you decided that you do not believe in God anymore because every time you pray, you don't necessarily get an answer. I mean, sometimes you get what you want and sometimes you don't. It's kind of like flipping a coin. And so that makes you decide that, hey, I don't believe in God anymore. So somebody asks you, well, why don't you believe in God anymore? And you tell them, well, this is the reason. This is the one reason why I don't believe in God anymore. And then they explain to you, and I'm not going to attempt to do this, but they explain to you why that's a very bad reason and why God doesn't answer prayers all the time and so forth. And it's a cogent argument. It's a reasonable response and it's very plausible. And then you get all flustered and you say, well, what about the problem of evil? Or what about divine hiddenness? And you start rattling off some more arguments. Then you are moving the goalposts because you gave the impression at the beginning that the singular reason why you don't believe in God is because of not answering prayers. And that point was legitimately and reasonably addressed, and you did not accept that and say, oh, okay, yeah, maybe I could see that now. I need to think about this more. But you just went on and rattling off more arguments. So here's the key as to when it's a fallacy or not. The more one stresses the importance or the singularity of the reason that is up for debate, then the more fallacious it is when more reasons are being brought up after that reason has been addressed. There are two really important elements of the Nirvana fallacy that are required in order to make it a fallacy. First of all, you have to compare something to an ideal situation. That's the first part. The second part is you have to seriously discount or even dismiss a possibility based on this comparison. So I have three examples for you. The first one is religious in nature, and I am sure you heard of this one before. It says that because we are not perfect, because we are all imperfect beings and we fail to live up to this ideal standard set in the imagination by certain religious figures, then we are all deserving of eternal torture and punishment. Now, that's an extreme, and it sounds like a straw man in a way, but for the most part, it's not. It would only be a straw man if somebody never made that argument. But I am saying this as a generic argument that has been made before and has been made several times. The argument does go that we are all deserving of hell by default because we are not perfect. And that's because we are comparing, or they are comparing ourselves to this ideal perfect standard, which is the Nirvana fallacy. Another example in business would be if you have a really good business idea, or let's say you're brainstorming with a few partners or business associates, and you're talking about a solution to a problem, and you come up with this ideal solution, but that's one that's just completely impractical, one that will never work, and you know that, but it's out there. And you're trying to get close to it, and you're coming up with all these different ideas, and you keep on comparing your ideas to this ideal strategy and this ideal solution, justifying these ideas as not being good enough because this other idea is so great, and this other solution is the best, and therefore not taking any action whatsoever. Or not going with any of the other ideas or any of the other business opportunities because they're not bringing you to this ideal situation that exists in the mind only. And one more example is abstinence. Let's say that the ideal solution for teenage pregnancy is abstinence, and assuming that abstinence up to the point of marriage. That's what's important here. So ideally, if no teenagers ever had sex, then that is the perfect solution. There wouldn't be any teenage pregnancies with unwanted children. There would be no abortions for teenagers and so forth. That would be great. However, that is an ideal situation that is not very practical at all. So to deny birth control is falling for this Nirvana fallacy. And being guilty of it, because condoms and other forms of birth control are a good solution to the problem of teenage pregnancy. Are they the best solution? No. I'm sure there are other solutions that are better, abstinence being one of them, if everybody were to be abstinent and there was no human emotions involved, which, of course, there are. You cannot remove that from the equation. But The thing is here, in an ideal world, this could be the perfect solution to the problem. But the problem is we do not live in this ideal world. Therefore, it's not an ideal or practical solution. Thinking that it is and thinking that we can hit that ideal and discounting these other options such as condoms and other birth control, sex education, and the list goes on. that is fallacious. And that is a great example of the Nirvana fallacy. I'd like to speak about this idea of unfalsifiability. Basically, it's this idea that something cannot be proven. It's unprovable. There are many unprovable claims being made in the world today, and that doesn't mean that they are all fallacious. It simply means that they cannot be proven. But there are circumstances where they become fallacious, and we'll talk about those in a little bit. There is a temporal aspect to unfalsifiability, meaning that right now we could say, scientists could claim, or astrophysicists, or somebody could claim that there is a multiverse and we are not the only universe, or there's a high probability of it or something. And this could be done purely by inductive reasoning based on the observations of other aspects of the universe. But technically, this is unfalsifiable because you cannot prove it or you cannot disprove it, not at this time. But that doesn't mean it's an eternally unfalsifiable claim. And in that matter, philosophically speaking, you really can't say anything is eternally unfalsifiable. There are things that we are unlikely to ever know, but we cannot say that with any amount of certainty because we cannot know the future. It's the whole idea of tomorrow, we'll never know if we can't say for sure that the sun is still going to rise or if the sun is going to explode tomorrow. We don't know. The fact that it's been circling the Earth for billions of years, it doesn't necessarily mean it's still going to circle the Earth tomorrow. So we don't know that. So this idea of unfalsifiability does sort of have a time element to it as well. So when is it actually fallacious and when is it not? Well, in my book, I use the example of making the claim that there are tiny invisible unicorns living in my anus. Actually, I don't think it was me in the example, but the person's in the example. But let's just, for this example, say that it's my anus, and they're my invisible unicorns. Which is all in good. You know, if I want to say that, and you don't believe me or not, you could just take it or leave it. And most likely you'll think I'm crazy, and you have the right to. But really, not too much harm has been done. But now, what if I were to claim that these tiny invisible unicorns are causing my antisocial behavior? And every now and then I just decide to kick an old lady because of these tiny invisible unicorns. And that is my claim. That is my assertion. And you are trying to reason with me that there are no tiny unicorns living in my anus doing that. I'm kicking these old ladies for other reasons, and we need to figure out what those other reasons are. But I refuse to believe that because I believe these tiny invisible unicorns, they're the things that are causing this antisocial behavior. This is where it becomes a problem. This is where my unfalsifiable claims are getting in the way of rational discourse and a decent debate in order to get to the truth of the matter, and in order to basically solve the problem at hand. So this is just one example of when something is actually, when an unfalsifiable claim is being made that becomes problematic. Proving non-existence is a simple fallacy, one that doesn't require a lot of explanation. Basically, it's just demanding proof of something's non-existence, as opposed to having the other person provide evidence of the existence of that thing. And this is done many times in religion, of course, with any certain religious practitioner's deity. It can also be done with other mystical beings, such as Bigfoot. I've heard that before. Trying to prove, well, you can't prove that he doesn't exist. Or UFOs, that's a common one as well. You can't prove that they don't exist. Well, no, you can't. This is an impossible standard again, proving something's non-existence in a basically limitless universe. We discussed this in one of the earlier lessons, that if you're proving the non-existence of something in a limited space, then that's something realistic. That's something that you can do. For example, I believe I used in the book, if you think that I spit in your drink, well, we could look in your drink and we should be able to see a big gob of spit. If you don't see a big gob of spit in there, we basically have proven, or at least provided evidence of, the non-existence of the spit. Now, I know I could have mixed it in so you can't see it, and I'm just sticking with the major point here. The point being that there are times when you can prove the non-existence of something if that existence is limited to a certain place and time, and that's it's possible to actually disprove. But for the most part, this fallacy refers to demanding proof of non-existence, the non-existence of something which cannot be disproven. And that lack of being disproved is actually something that provides evidence to the other person that that something exists. And that's fallacious thinking. Taking that inability to disprove something as evidence of that something's existence. The definest fallacy is not one that's commonly known by name, but one that certainly gets used a lot on the internet. It's this idea of defining a term or a concept in such a way that makes it easier to defend. Now, this is sort of a form of a straw man. If you remember a straw man is the idea that you are misrepresenting the opponent's argument to make it easier to take down and destroy. Well, the definest fallacy is sort of doing the same thing, but it could be the reverse. You're defining a term in such a way that makes your argument easier to win. And I would say a version of the definest fallacy can also be defining a term in such a way that makes your opponent's argument easier to destroy. So you're not necessarily misrepresenting the argument, but you are misrepresenting a term that is being used within the argument. So there is a kind of a fuzzy line there, but it is certainly a form of the straw man argument. I would also argue that the idea of refusing to acknowledge the possibility of different definitions could be subsumed under this fallacy as well. If you're engaged in debate with somebody, and somebody is saying, well, I believe that abortion means this, and then you're saying, well, I think abortion means this, and you're both sticking to your guns, and you're both refusing to acknowledge that in a way you're both right and in a way you're both wrong. The idea that a certain definition or many definitions are quite fluid and do have many different interpretations and meanings, it's not an exact science when we're dealing with terminology. And you're insistent on this word being what you think it means, then you're committing a form of this fallacy. A perfect example of this is a debate that I recently heard between two atheists about the idea of objective morality. One was arguing for an objective morality, and the other was arguing against. And it all comes down to this definition of objective. What do we mean by objective? Well, if you look up objective in the dictionary, you are going to get many different definitions. Just in the dictionary alone, if you look up objective in philosophy journals, well, this goes on for pages and pages and pages about what objective could actually mean in certain contexts, depending on what century, depending on who was writing about it. There are many different definitions of it. So there is no one true concept of what objective means. If you define objective in the term of objective morality as that which leads to the greatest amount of human well-being, well, that's very different than defining it objective as independent of the human mind. The two terms are different, and it is much easier to defend an objective morality if you're going with the first definition. as opposed to defending an objective morality if you're going with the second. So when in debate or argumentation, look out for somebody redefining a term in such a way in which you don't agree. And point it out and say, and don't be accusatory. Don't say you're defining this wrong, because then you're guilty. Say that this definition, you're using it differently than I'm using it. And let's talk about that. And then, sure, you could go back to sources and you could provide sources on why your definition is the better definition. But keep in mind that it doesn't necessarily mean your definition is the right definition. And if you are arguing about an idea or a concept, getting caught up in words just gets in the way of coming to a solution and agreeing on something of real importance. A possible solution when you do get caught up in terminology is to agree to use another word, or agree to replace that word with a phrase or several different words that more accurately represents what you mean. And you'll get much further in the debate by doing something like that. Appealing to the possibility is basically just bad statistical thinking. It's the whole idea that because something is possible, that it's probable. Before we talked, I know we talked about the difference between plausibility and probability. Now we're talking about the difference between possibility and probability. There is a belief that anything is possible. And of course, if you define possible, depending on how you define it, talking about our last fallacy, the definist fallacy, you can say that anything is possible. If you define it in another way, something that cannot defy logic, then there are things that are impossible. In fact, if you are interested, I did write a pretty detailed article on things that are actually impossible, according to my definition. And you can find that on my relationshipwithreason.com website. But this fallacy occurs when somebody makes the claim that because something is possible, that it is probable. They basically confuse this whole idea of possibility and probability, and they make the argument for something based on the possibility alone, and that is fallacious. A lot of times this happens as a result of wishful thinking. They want something so desperately to be true that just the mere possibility of it is enough for them to hold that belief. And sometimes that's not a bad thing. That's how hope works. And perhaps this idea of possibility, this idea of hope, is what kept people from dying in war camps. So there is a place for it. But as we know, our wishful thinking and our hope and the mere possibility does not often coincide with reason and rational thought, and more importantly, probability. Now, you could technically still appeal to the possibility while not being fallacious by an admission of this idea of appealing to the possibility and admission of the statistical improbability of such an outcome happening. So for example, if I were to say that I wanted to justify my idea of buying a lottery ticket, and I have to get up, I have to go to the store, I got to get dressed, I got to drive across town, and I'm going to spend $5 in lottery tickets, and then I'm going to come back. So there's some effort involved there. So in order to justify that, how would I do that? Well, I can't say that because it's possible, then I am going to win, or I believe I'm going to win. But I could justify it by saying, look, I know it's highly improbable, but I'm going to do it anyway because the possibility, the mere possibility of winning such a massive jackpot makes it worth it to me to take the action and spend $5 just for the mere chance of that possibility. There are many cases in life where we take major risks based on a low probability of an outcome, and there's nothing wrong with that. the fallacy is involved in thinking and believing that your statistical chances of succeeding in such a case is much higher than it actually is. And that's where wishful thinking gets caught up in there. So it's this whole idea of being, you could say that it's an idea of being an optimist versus a pessimist or a realist. And realist is the way to go. But I could talk for that, talk about that for a while as well, which I don't want to get into here, but I believe that optimism, pessimism really have different meanings. This is the whole idea of just statistical thinking, probability, and realizing the actual odds and making decision based on the odds rather than making a decision based on the perceived odds that are far off. And you're making these bad judgments on the odds based purely on the idea of possibility as opposed to probability. And I will mention this fallacy of appealing to the moon. Essentially, it's the same thing. It's the same fallacy. It's just a very specific version of it. It's the whole idea of saying, well, you know, if man could go to the moon, then we could certainly bake a cake in 6 minutes. Or anything. Follow that with anything that is next to impossible or very difficult, and you have yourself the appeal to the moon. And if you think about the reasoning, it makes sense. Yes, flying to the moon and landing on the moon and walking on the moon is incredibly difficult, but it's difficult in its own way. There are other things that are incredibly difficult. It is incredibly difficult for me, a 42-year-old 5'11" man, to dunk a basketball. But just because men have landed on the moon and walked on the moon, it doesn't have anything to do with my chances of dunking a basketball. Basically, it's just a little linguistic trick. It's just rhetoric to try to make something sound more possible than it really is, when it's really not.